Welcome to the Union for Reform Judaism's Parenting Podcast. I'm Wendy Grinberg, Parenting Specialist. Today, our guest expert is Dr. Shana Ehrenberg, the co-founder and president of the Board of Directors of the Libenu Foundation, which is an independent living facility in Chicago for Jewish adults with special needs. She's the chairman of the Department of Education and professor at Blitzstein Institute of Hebrew Theological College in Chicago. And she maintains a private practice for children and adults with special needs. She was also a national honoree in the 2011 Jewish Community Hero Contest, and she's helped us create some of our special needs resources at the Union for Reform Judaism. In this first segment, we talk about how treatment and diagnosis of special needs has changed and the pros and cons of inclusion. Let's start by defining what we mean by special needs.
Sometimes it's useful to categorize disabilities according to IDEA, the Individuals with Disability Education Act, those categories, or sometimes using the DSM-4, but not all special needs are going to be fitting nicely into a specific category. But typically, when we're talking about special needs, we're talking about developmental delays, individuals who are on the autism spectrum, speech and language problems, learning disabilities, emotional needs, behavior needs, attention issues, physical disabilities, deaf, blind, hearing impaired, vision impaired. So there really is a very broad category. When we take a look and we want to kind of put a general understanding out there, when we have children that are not developing in a typical way, they're not reaching their milestones within their specific times, or we start to see concerns about how they're developing overall, that's the time where you want to start to think about, is there something that's going on? So the best way, I think, to think about it is to look at the deviation from typical development.
Can you reflect on how treatment, diagnosis, parenting, educating special needs children has changed since you've been in the field?
Oh, it's really come quite a long way. I know when I first started out, and I've been in the field, wow, a really long time. It's about 35 years, 36 years. And when I first started out, there was, actually we saw quite a different view of disabilities. So, for example, you know that I'm one of the founders of Keshet and that I was the director of the Sunday school for 20 years. So when we first started Sunday school, we had a real cross-section of special needs. We had children with Down syndrome and we had children with cerebral palsy. And I think maybe at that time we had one child on the autism spectrum. As the years went on, and maybe, you know, 10 years later, the shift in the types of special needs that we saw was dramatic. So we saw less of the CP types of issues, less deafness and blindness, but a dramatic increase in children who were on the autism spectrum. So that was kind of an interesting shift, and I think the increase in the identified population kind of came along hand in hand with an increase in research in the field, an increase in, you know, advances in understanding the disability, advances in technology that really helped children communicate and access information that they might not have had access to otherwise. So that's been a dramatic change too. When we first started seeing young children on the spectrum 25 years ago, and you compare what those kids were like developmentally to many children that I see today on the spectrum, their prognosis and their skills and their abilities are very different. And it's a diverse population, so you can't really make sweeping generalizations. But I think that early identification has improved. I think the technologies have improved. And so I think what we're seeing now are children who are developing better skills and earlier skills, and that's been a really nice change to see over the years.
Are there other trends in special education that are encouraging to you?
Absolutely. First of all, we just talked about technology. So I think that the trends in technology are just remarkable. I think the iPad, for example, is going to open up worlds to children with special needs. And I'm not just referring to kids on the spectrum, but children with learning disabilities, individuals with communication needs, with physical disabilities. There's a lot of technologies that many of my private clients use with me for reading, for example. You know, the Kurzweil program, which helps children who are struggling with reading access content material at their age and interest level that they wouldn't otherwise be able to read. There are programs for written language. There's programs for communication. There's programs that teach social skills. So I think that technology is a huge improvement and a huge advancement and a trend that I'm just thrilled to see actually on a daily basis. And then inclusion has really kind of swept through the special education field, and it's a trend that overall is encouraging, but there's also some concerns that go along with that.
Can you talk about that a little bit and about this sort of school of thought, pro-inclusion and anti?
The inclusion movement actually is a result of the Corey H. decision, which was a court case in Illinois that was brought by this student and his family. And the essence of the court case was that children with special needs who were being educated in categorical classrooms. So, you know, back in the 70s, you had a classroom for kids with cognitive impairments, and you had a classroom with kids with physical disabilities, and you had a classroom for students with learning disabilities. It was very categorical. And often, these students were educated in classes that were shoved in the basement or off the beaten path, and there were no opportunities or limited opportunities for interaction with their typical peers. And so this case was presented, and the findings of the case were that that was discriminatory, that you could not educate children separately, that they had to be included to the fullest extent possible, and that became part of the law, really part of IDEA and the laws that came before that and the revisions that came after that. So from that case and from the law, the whole inclusion movement was born. And the theory behind inclusion is absolutely phenomenal, and that is that we do not want children with special needs to be educated apart, to not have access to the general curriculum, to not have access to their typical peers. But the problem with the inclusion movement is that we don't really have teachers in the general education setting that understand and can teach students with special needs. And so because of that, what's happened with the inclusion movement is that it's become more of a tolerance movement. So we include these children in the classroom, and they're sitting there, and very often there's an aide that's there with them, and the aide is helping them with their instruction, but the aide is not a trained teacher, and they're not really on par with the class. The social aspect that they're gaining from being in the class, sometimes it's very, very helpful because there's positive role models for language and positive role models for behavior, but they may not be getting the academic instruction that they need to help them close the gap or to help them maximize their potential. And sometimes even the socialization isn't as beneficial as we'd hope it would be. So, you know, yes, they're in class, and yes, the children are nice to them in class, but nobody's inviting them over after school. They're not necessarily invited to birthday parties. So we really have to weigh, when we're thinking about inclusion, we have to weigh the benefits with the costs. And my own personal philosophy is that we have to look at creative inclusion versus full inclusion. And by that I mean, where can we include so that it maximizes the experience for the child with special needs? And where do we have to pull that child out to maximize the intervention that we're going to give them to hopefully make them independent and able to function in, you know, in society? In Hebrew school in particular, I think that's really important because there are going to be some things that the child can be included in very easily and some things that may not be appropriate for the child to be included in. So if you've got a child who absolutely has no concept of, you know, reading or Hebrew letters and they need individualized instruction, even to begin that, it's not necessarily a good idea to throw them into a class with a bunch of kids who are learning much more advanced skills in terms of reading. However, that child, they love the plays and the assemblies and the rabbi's presentations and music, and they should be fully included for that. So we have to be very creative about how we include kids in different programs. You know, another issue is, can a child, I've had students that when they come into school, if they're coming in with a crowd of kids, it sets them off because the actual commotion kind of overstimulates them and they can't process it through. And so then behaviorally there's lots of issues just because they happen to come into the building with 100 other children. And when we look at a full inclusion model, well, we want them coming in, we want them in the regular classroom, but maybe they need to get there 15 minutes earlier or 15 minutes later. We have to be very creative, and we have to think about what works for each individual child, and then we have to have a philosophy of inclusion that starts at the top, that the principal is okay with this and the teachers are okay with this. And then once we've got that, once you have a philosophy of inclusion and you can be creative and think out of the box, you can open up a world of possibilities.
Thank you for listening to the Union for Reform Judaism's Parenting Podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast, find more resources, including links and discussion guides, and let us know what you think at urj.org/parents.